Hello and welcome to The Leap of Faith. Well, this evening we've invited a number of guests into the studio and together we're going to try and answer some particular questions. Did Jesus need to die? And what if Pilate had released him? The events leading up to the arrest and crucifixion of Jesus are well told by the gospel writers, as are stories of the resurrection. But why did Jesus die? Well, joining me this evening are Dr. Anne Thurston, theologian and writer, the Reverend Seamus O'Connell, Professor of Sacred Scripture at Maynooth College, and Dr. Zalika Rogers, Assistant Professor of Jewish Studies at Trinity College Dublin. You're all very welcome to The Leap of Faith.
Thank you.
Dr. Zalika Rogers, can I begin with you? What historical background information do we have regarding the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth, and what was the role of Josephus?
Well, the problem for historians is that there isn't much written by the actual followers of Jesus in the first century. The Roman sources that we have for Jesus don't actually date until the beginning of the second century. But we do have one important source, which is the writer, the Jewish writer, Flavius Josephus. Now, he was born after Jesus's death. He was born in 37. He is from a priestly aristocratic family in Jerusalem. When the war broke out between the Jews and the Romans in 66 CE, he ended up being a commander in that war. He was captured. He ended up in Roman chains. And the stories here turn a little bit strange, and he wrote them himself. But he ends up in Rome in the 70s writing under Roman patronage. He writes a number of very important works which tell us all about history of Judean society and culture in the first century. And the first book he writes is in the 70s of the Common Era. It's a 7-volume, it's written in Greek, overview of the Jewish war between the Romans and the Jews. He then, in the 90s, publishes a 20-volume history of the Jews, starts with creation and finishes on the eve of the revolt in 66. He then writes 2 other shorter works. Now, Josephus happens not only to mention John the Baptist and James, the brother of Jesus, but he also has a small short passage that mentions a Jesus figure who was crucified by Pilate.
Was there any interference with his writing subsequently that you're aware of?
Well, Josephus's texts have a very interesting transmission reception history. They were preserved by Christian scribes for a number of reasons. One was because he described the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans, which later in Christian interpreters understood as being punishment by God for the Jews not following Jesus. So here was a Jewish witness. Some of the church fathers also depended on looked to his biblical interpretation, and also because he mentions these figures. Now, the problem with the text on Jesus of Nazareth is that when you analyze the language, it looks as if there have been some later interpolations into the original text. And so there's been centuries of debate about what part of it is real and authentic, Josephus, and what part is not. And it has a very complicated manuscript history as well, which adds to the mystery. There is some sort of consensus today about this passage, which is known as the Testimonium Flavianum, that a kernel of it may very well have been written by Josephus. And later, when he mentions James, the brother of Jesus, it's assumed that he has already mentioned Jesus.
So we're working on a basis of proof. Other Seamus O'Connell, clarify if you would the writing of the New Testament and how it was put together. Can we apply the same rules that we would apply now to, you know, journalism, verification and record keeping to a document such as the Bible?
Well, I suppose the first thing one needs to say is that the Gospels are ancient texts. So we're looking at texts that are coming from the end of the first century of the Common Era, and how people went about writing things and why they wrote them and what they wanted people to be convinced of might be somewhat different in some ways to what a journalist, for example, who is looking at truth in a very forensic sort of way, or how a journalist would go around about his task. So maybe the best image might be how one would draw a portrait. So what we have really in the Gospels are 4 portraits of Jesus and of disciples and of the world and of course we're talking on Good Friday, of Jesus's death. And those four portraits of Jesus's death are very, very different.
We live in a time now, 2017, where we have a new phrase in the English language of alternative facts. Mm-hmm. And the idea that information will be manipulated is probably the strong word, but will be changed to suit the storyteller.
Well, I suppose we need to take on board that every time we tell something, we interpret something. So that even from one's tone and the intonation, the meaning can change. So is there an interpretation of the historical datum that Jesus died, or Jesus, let's maybe be a little bit more precise, that Jesus was executed? Is that datum interpreted for those who have come to believe in him as their Lord and their God? The answer to that is yes, absolutely. And the Gospels don't run away from that. I think sometimes we think that the people who read the Gospels in the early days and those who wrote them were somehow oblivious to each other. And common scholarship would say that the Gospels, usually scholars will say Mark was the earliest and Matthew and Luke are a rewriting of Mark. And there's an opinion there that sometimes we feel that once a later gospel was written, that the other gospel disappeared. But it's like having a piece of music which is an interpretation of another piece of music. The interpretation maybe really only works when you've the two before you.
Okay, so we've set out our stall here. Dr. Anne Thurston, what would have happened then? And let's go back to our question. If Pilate had released Jesus at 33 years of age, said, off you go, what would you think would have been the outcome then from us from a Christian point of view?
Well, I'm going to come to that in 1 minute, but first of all, I wanted to say, respond to a little bit to what Seamus was saying. Not only do we have no uninterpreted facts when we come to read the Gospels, but we read them through layers and centuries of further interpretation.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to come back to your question, but
sure.
I like to compare this to the readings of any narrative or any story. And what you really need to ask about is, you ask different questions about truth when you're reading a story. So the question I want to ask, you know, does this ring true? And I think it's a good way of coming at it. Mind you, I think the most famous question of Pilate could hardly be more pertinent now. What is truth? And we're probably still waiting for the answer, or is it something that's embodied there? So now returning to your question, well, a number of things occurred to me about this. First of all, it is utterly fascinating how many people are interested in Pilate and interested in a fictional way in Pilate. Mm. And I wonder, is this because he comes across in the Gospels, in the way these stories are told, as such a very human figure who is vacillating, who doesn't really know what to do. He doesn't seem to be somebody with a strong enough sense of his own authority. He's weak. So he gives in and says, OK, have it your way. But let's imagine that he did listen to the warnings of his wife and said, OK, I cannot have the blood of this man on my hands, and washing them isn't going to do it. So we'll release him. So there are a few different answers to what might have happened. A very quick answer is, well, the mob would have taken over. So we could say that. Another answer might be, you know, Pilate might suddenly then become one of the disciples, or might himself have been lynched and therefore be one of the first martyrs. But, and this is not my idea, I was listening to Mark Tully of the neighbouring radio station across the water talking about Pilate recently, and he was quoting a French author, I don't know whether any of you know of him, called Roger Caillou. And this writer imagines what might have happened if Pilate had released Jesus. So he speculates about this and he says, well, first of all, there would be widespread rejoicing. You know, we really thought this man was going to die, but now he's free. And isn't this wonderful? This would be suddenly a miraculous triumph of justice and so on. So that's the beginning. This is all in Caillou's idea. But then after a short while, this becomes a huge disadvantage. It becomes a huge disadvantage because people become quite bored. You know, they follow this saintly man for a while. He dies at a great age, and that's it. And so Tully then comments, we have to thank Pilate, because without Pilate, where's our story? So this brings us then to very unusual and interesting questions. This question about the inevitability of the death, or as Seamus so correctly says, the execution of Jesus. And I think this is a very interesting question. So theologically, do we say this is divine necessity? I have a problem with that. Or do we want to say something about the human historical context and the inevitability that if you love to that extent, if you live in the particular way that he lived, then you will be put to death.
All right, so let's broaden this out a little bit more now. The idea that, first of all, and maybe Zuleika, you could help us with this, is the idea of atonement and that this had to happen. And it was part of an Old Testament idea that people made sacrifices and the death of Jesus would ultimately be the final sacrament in this case.
Well, I suppose that it's symbolic, of course, that it's at Passover. And of course, Passover was one of the sacrificial pilgrimage festivals to Jerusalem where the sacrifices would have taken place. So that is highly symbolic. But if you don't mind me just taking it back a little bit, because first of all, if you look at the evidence, there is no evidence that in Jewish and Roman law, this would have been permitted. A murderer had to have been punished. So nobody would have been released. Especially there are no other sources for this. And Josephus tells us, and of course Josephus has his own purpose and aims and agenda when writing as well, but he does tell us that the Romans are particularly sensitive around Passover time and the periods of festivals because disorder can break out. So the idea that you would release a criminal during this time is really not historically backed up. I should also say that the representation of Pilate in the Gospels, you've already been talking about the purpose and writing of the Gospels, what the Gospel writers wanted to do. Of course, they wanted to proclaim the good news, which was their experience of the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth as Christ. But they also at the same time wanted to make claims about being the real Israel. They were the inheritors of Israel. And so what the gospel writers do is remove guilt from Pilate and make Pilate into a much more complex character and place all the guilt on the Jews, on the high priests, the chief priests, and of course on Judas. And I think that's very important to keep that in mind, because Josephus tells us about Pilate. Now, again, he wants to portray Roman maladministration of Judea, but he presents Pilate as arriving in 26 of the Common Era, and there's just one incident after the other of persecution of the locals until he's sent home in 36.
A very interesting idea on this is that if you were a defense lawyer for Jesus at the time and put forward an appeal afterwards, his trial wasn't carried out according to Jewish law.
No.
It was
no.
done at night. It wasn't done in the correct venue and no witnesses were called. The stitch up, who was behind it?
Seamus?
That I was behind it.
But I think these are the gospel sources for this.
Just maybe to pick up on something that Anne said, because maybe it brings a level of historical verisimilitude into our conversation. This interpreter, Caillou, whom you mentioned, I'm not so sure if Jesus had been released, and I take your point, Zuleika, that you have somebody who is in a dire situation and to release him and have a climb down is makes a volatile situation more volatile. But had he been released, I'm not so sure that there would have been such huge rejoicing, because I'm not so sure how big a figure Jesus was historically. We have these gospel accounts. Last Sunday, many Christians celebrated Passion Sunday, this ritual and liturgical almost entry of this man who is being proclaimed as king. This is the problem, or this is the issue. One of the ways of envisaging the Messiah, and I suppose historically the most widespread way of envisaging the Messiah, was to see him as a king. And this king would ideally be, that's where the name, the title comes from. Mashiach in Hebrew is the one who is anointed, and that is exactly what Christos in Greek means. So there, this is laden with this, but this is a moment. Even if it is historical, it is a moment.
Mm. And Seamus, that moment, do you see that crowd? Two questions about that, actually, which interests me. Do you see that crowd as a small crowd rather than a large crowd greeting Jesus? And do you go with Marcus Borg and John Dominic Crossan, who talk about, maybe this is just to give us this image of Pilate entering the city from one side with his military retinue and horses, and then Jesus on the donkey coming in from the other side, setting that up really as two opposing ideas of power and how power is manifest.
Well, yes, that certainly the Gospels are doing a narrative of power and status and honour. And we have two different honour systems and status systems being confronted.
Mm. Were the Roman authorities being used by the Jewish authorities in order to get their dirty work done? Zuleika.
Well, I think that that's what the Gospels want to say, because they are the ones, I mean, the writers of the Gospels are, as I said, they're trying to claim for themselves the inheritance of Israel. And somebody like, you know, the writer of the Gospel of Matthew, for example, very, very Jewish, and he's looking across maybe the road to the synagogue community there. And my old professor, Sean Frayne, once entitled an article, Vilifying the Other and Defining the Self. So what they're trying to do is define who they are, because remember, they are not sure who they are. This is a very new movement that wants to set themselves in the ancient world to show that you had a very antique inheritance was what gave you legitimacy. So they needed the legitimacy of being part of this long history of Israel.
This is a very important point. This discourse against the Jews. We who are not Jews are reading this and saying, oh, well, it was the Jews against Jesus whom we have taken to ourselves. But Jesus was a Jew.
I know.
The disciples were Jews.
You can't repeat that often enough, I think.
This is so you read the Gospel of John, and the Jews did this, and the Jews did this and did that against Jesus. Like, who was Jesus? Mm.
This being written, though, a number of years after the event, they now had a new identity. They no longer saw themselves as Jews as they told the story, possibly. Would that be part of it?
Well, I suppose they saw themselves, maybe the best way of looking at that, they saw themselves as a new type of Jew. And
they weren't defining themselves as Christians yet, is my question then.
Well, they are defining themselves as Christians, maybe not using that term so early on, but certainly something new within what was, and this is an important consideration, Judaism in the first century in Galilee and in Judea, especially in Judea, was quite diverse.
Can I spend a little time in this conversation just exploring the concept of possible predestination, that it was predetermined, predestined that this had to happen? And you're all making faces for the listeners at home. Let's hear your answers.
I think that is a statement that comes out of the sources which are written post-resurrection, trying to make sense of the crucifixion and death of the leader of this movement. And I think Seamus, I agree with Seamus, and I think it can't be said enough that the contribution to the understanding of who Jesus was and Jesus' message and the reason for his death, so much of that lies with the early Christian writers. They contribute to the understanding of that historical experience. And you must not underestimate the contribution of Paul and the gospel writers.
If I could take that up, I'm making faces. I don't know why Anne and Zuleika are making faces, but I'm making a face because predestination is not a term that is very early. It really, in some ways, comes into medieval or Renaissance thought or discourse. It's there earlier, certainly. But it grabs the popular imagination much, much later. Now, there are two dimensions to the question. One is, and I think this is important, I might reframe it, what has God to do with the way that Jesus dies? That's, I think that may be the more...
Fulfilling scripture is what we're led to
believe. Fulfilling scripture, and that is that's a formula that's used especially in Matthew, which operates as a literary work in a very Jewish mode. But it's at the basis of all these Christian texts that these authors see themselves as bringing out a fulfillment of the scripture, which within Judaism would in a particular way be seen as the expression of God's will. So if X and Y and Z happen to fulfill the scripture, it is a Jewish way of saying, because Jews would never presume to say God wanted this, but it is a way of saying within this environment in the first century that God wishes this and God is involved in this.
And Thurston?
So why was I making a face? I think I was making a face because I think the idea of Jesus going passively and willingly to his death as if death was what he desired is what I find somewhat repugnant, I suppose. What is bringing me to think about all these things in a fresh way, I was going to say I brought my granddaughter, but that's not true. I didn't bring my granddaughter into her local church. She brought me recently, and she's 5, and she marches up to the top and proceeds to say her prayers in you know, a very, very simple, very nice way. But then she pointed to the cross for the first time. She said, "Granny, do you know who that is?" And I said, "You tell me." She said, "That's Jesus, and he's dead." I said, "Okay." And as we walked out of the church, I thought, how, as her questions will inevitably come, how will I feel about explaining that to her? And do I want her to be confronted? I'm going to express this rather. Do I want her to be confronted with an instrument of torture each time she goes into the church, when at the moment, you know, her sense of what this is about is of a very loving God to whom she can pray and say, you know, look after my baby brother or whatever it is. And of course, it wasn't always traditional to have a crucified Christ in the church. In the beginning, the cross was considered, is this not so shameless, such a scandal, that there were very few depictions of it, Santa Sabina in Rome being one of the first in the 5th century. So I somehow think that we need to get back to the idea that in the first place, that's why I liked your notion of execute it. That the death of Jesus in the first place is a human tragedy, an act of violence and an atrocity. And I don't think we should be dwelling on it except to be appalled by it or to remind us to be appalled by other atrocities.
But Anne, I think there's a part of that I think is very valid. But there is another nuance there from a Christian perspective, that while the iconography of the cross comes later, there are earlier images. But the power of the cross is there from the earliest layers of witness. So Paul in Galatians, which
certainly
is very
verbally.
Early. Yes, verbally. And that,
verbally.
And that verbal witness and what's behind it is profound. There's something pivotal in this. This was pivotal for Paul, that it wasn't just that this person, whom we call Jesus of Nazareth, that he had preached and this, but that he had been executed in this way. This said something not only about his identity, but this said something about God.
But what is it saying about God?
Well, I suppose in some ways
that's crucial.
To come back to our earlier speculation, which we didn't, I suppose, really push to the end, that had Jesus been released, Jesus would have died.
Exactly.
So
yes.
So that death is not something that is beyond God's plan. So that's...
But Seamus, we would have missed the resurrection. We're talking about Good Friday and we have to bring in Easter Sunday.
We have to bring in Easter Sunday, but we need to maybe try and separate or have some discipline, if I can say that, in how we think things. Any death of Jesus could have brought a resurrection of Jesus. What's really interesting is this absolute death of terror and degradation, it is most likely that Jesus, like those of his time, was crucified naked, which is abhorrent to Jewish culture. It is a very shameful act and shameful thing to be displayed naked. And he is crucified naked, and this was terror.
Well, as we're coming towards the end of the programme already, just a reminder that we're talking with Anne Thurston, with the Reverend Seamus O'Connell, and with Zuleika Rogers. One word answer from all of you as we finish the programme this evening. Did Jesus have to die, Anne?
Yes, he did, because of how he lived.
Seamus?
Yes, he did, because death is part of life.
Zuleika?
Everyone dies.
What if Pilate had released Jesus?
If Pilate had released Jesus, where would Bach's Matthew Passion be? We would be deprived of all of these. The extraordinary shaping of the Western culture has actually been shaped through all these events. So whether we consider Pilate to be an instrument of history or story, the outcome of this has been quite an extraordinary shaping of our culture.
If Pilate had released Jesus, would Jesus have changed at all?
If Pilate had released Jesus, he would have transgressed both Jewish and Roman law.
And that's the Leap of Faith for this evening. Can I thank our guests this evening, Dr. Anne Thurston, Reverend Seamus O'Connell, and Dr. Zuleika Rogers. From all of us here, good night.